Our fourth case for argument this morning is Dunmire v. Schneider. Ms. Hardy.
If it pleases the Court, Counsel, Your Honors, this appeal raises but one legal issue, and that is the interpretation of an arbitration provision under a unique set of facts, and the determination under those unique set of facts whether my client, Delbert Dunmire, waived his constitutional right to a trial by jury. The facts can be summarized briefly as follows. Mr. Dunmire was a client of Morgan Stanley, then Dean Witter, since the mid-1980s. He had two prior account agreements, both of which contained arbitration provisions, and both of which specifically said, you agree to arbitrate your claims against Dean Witter, its employees, its representatives, and its agents. In December of
those prior agreements that you're referring to deal with futures accounts?
At that time, Your Honor, they were dealing with futures accounts. It's not until this later date that the futures account agreement became separate.
Now, actually, your client signed a futures agreement in 1997, and the arbitration clause in the 1997 agreement is identical to the arbitration clause in the 2000 agreement. Your representation that there was a change is inconsistent with the record.
The
agreements your client signed in 1989 and 1999 don't involve futures.
Correct, Your Honor.
Well, what you're saying is that there was a difference between the agreement for stock trading and the agreements for futures trading, but there's never been any change in the futures agreement. Now, I don't think any of this matters, but it's always of some concern to me when attorneys misrepresent the record.
Your Honor, on page 137 of the appendix is the page in which Mr. Dunmire signed a futures account agreement agreeing to arbitration on December the 4th, 2000. In that futures agreement, it drops the language.
No, that's your problem. It didn't drop any language. The agreement it replaced was the 1997 futures agreement, and it had identical language in it. I don't think you're going to go anywhere on this, so I suggest you continue with your argument. But comparing apples and oranges, comparing the language of the futures agreement to the language of the stock trading agreement, is not going to help you.
In December of 2000, the CFTC issued new regulations in which they required that arbitration be a optional part of any kind of agreement with customers. At the time that Mr. Dunmire signed this agreement in December 4th of 2000, the arbitration provision clearly stated, A, that it was optional, and B, that every dispute between customer and Dean Witter Reynolds arising out of or relating to the making or performance of this agreement may be subject to arbitration.
Help me with this, please, Ms. Hardy. What do you think is your best case support for the proposition that an agent is not bound by virtue of his status to his employer's arbitration agreement?
I think that while it's true that an employer or a company can only act through its employees, an employee can act on behalf of its employer or independently outside the course and scope of his employment. And so because some of the claims that were being asserted in this case were beyond that scope, those were not claims that fell within the specific arbitration provision that Mr. Dunmire agreed to sign. And because of the CFTC's new regulations strictly enforcing and making voluntary arbitration clauses, that it should only be enforced specifically in the terms to which he agreed. Now, not only were there different arbitration terms in prior agreements, but within this specific agreement, the language was used in different paragraphs. For example, in paragraph 1 of this specific agreement pertaining to limitation of liability, it specifically uses the term Dean Witter Reynolds, its officers, directors, employees, or agents, but it chose not to do that in the arbitration provision. In paragraph 8D, it specifically says Dean Witter Reynolds, its officers, employees, and agents, but it did not do so with respect to the arbitration provision. We believe that the court erred in ordering Mr. Dunmire to arbitrate this matter in light of the fact that this arbitration agreement provision itself specifically excludes agents, employees, and representatives, in light of the fact that this arbitration provision omits that language when it's found elsewhere within this same agreement, and in light of the fact that the CFTC regulations now require that arbitration is voluntary and no customer is ordered to do so.
Now, wouldn't your reading of the arbitration agreement render it nearly useless in that it could be easily circumvented by naming employees rather than Morgan Stanley itself?
I think that the logical interpretation would always mean that to the extent an employee is solely acting within the course and scope of his employment, that it would have to be within the scope of the arbitration provision. But there were allegations made that actions were taken for Mr. Schneider's own pecuniary benefit, and therefore it's those provisions that we seek to pursue outside of this arbitration. One of the things that I think that the trial court emphasized is that because Mr. Schneider had represented in the motion to dismiss that he sought to be dismissed from the federal case and to join the NFA arbitration that was currently going forward, that it would be more economical to allow that to do so. In fact, though, the court dismissed the case against Mr. Schneider on December the 15th, 2005. The NFA case did not go to trial until May of 06, yet no time in those 5 months did Mr. Schneider seek to join the NFA proceeding. So part of the basis on which the trial court had based its ruling did not occur.
What is the status of the reparation proceeding before the CFTC?
Yeah.
The reparation proceeding before the CFTC was dismissed.
Dismissed by an administrative law judge. What is its status?
It's totally dismissed.
You mean the CFTC itself has affirmed?
Yes.
Is a copy of that decision anywhere in the papers in this case?
I don't believe that it is, Your Honor.
It would certainly help us if you or the defendants provided that.
We can do so, Your Honor. We also raised the procedural issue simply that Morgan Stanley's motion to dismiss relied upon prior agreements when they argued for a motion to dismiss and not the final agreement that was then bearing on the parties at the time these events occurred. Morgan Stanley's motion to dismiss did not raise the 2000 agreement itself until it filed its reply brief. And we believe, just as a matter of procedure, that they've waived that argument and any arguments pertaining to that agreement. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hardy. Mr. Lewitis.
Good morning. May it please the court. The reason we know that the lower court decided this case properly is because a contrary result would condone the way that appellant has been acting in this proceeding ever since the cause of action.
Was there a request for an award of fees under Section 1927?
Excuse me?
Was there a request for an award of fees under Section 1927? I found that rather surprising. 28 U.S.C. 1927 requires the lawyers personally to pay attorney's fees when they vexatiously multiply the proceedings. And I should think this pattern is just an illustration of what it is that 1927 forbids. We're now up to 6 proceedings, I think.
I would concur. Unfortunately, I wasn't involved in that proceeding at the time. I came in for the appeal.
Just one question. Why shouldn't we read the distinctions within the 2000 Futures Agreement as indicative of an intent to include Morgan Stanley, but not employees or agents, given that many phrases explicitly referred to Dean Witter Reynolds, its employees or agents, and the arbitration part did not.
That would be an appropriate inquiry. I concur that if we were looking at this as a question of fact, we view this as a question of law. Is a corporate employee covered by the arbitration provision when their corporation enters into the agreement without reference to them? And the circuits that have addressed this issue have repeatedly found in favor of the corporate employee in this instance. While many circuits have not blanket adopted the agency exception to the non-signatory to the arbitration provision rule, in the context of a corporate employee trying to invoke the benefit of the corporation's arbitration clause, they've been allowed to every single time. The cases that have not allowed in that instance have a much more tenuous connection. For example, there's some sort of corporate relationship. But when we're dealing with a corporate employee, it's always been allowed. And while this circuit hasn't addressed it directly, we do have a case that I am remiss in saying we did not cite in our brief, but I would like to point it out here.
Have you filed a Rule 28J letter?
I have not.
Then you can't point it out here.
Then I will go back to cases that I did cite in our brief. In Zurich American versus Watts Industries, 417 F3rd 1682, the court specifically referenced the agency exception to the non-signatory rule, binding the employee to a company's arbitration clause. And the seminal case in this area is the Ninth Circuit's decision in Letizia. In that case, we have an identical fact situation here. A customer sued a brokerage firm. The brokerage firm's employees wanted to join in the arbitration, and the motion to compel arbitration was granted, and the same arguments that appellant is making here were rejected in that case, and the appellants were allowed to join. And this circuit has commented favorably in a number of cases on Letizia. But going back to your question, all of those issues of contract construction would only be relevant if we were looking at this from a question of fact standpoint. Even if it wasn't a question of law and we were going to go to whether this was a question of fact and how it should be decided, the Supreme Court's been very clear as to how ambiguities in construing arbitration clauses should be resolved. And that authority makes it abundantly clear that it should be resolved in favor of arbitration. To hear appellant state it, arbitration should be disfavored, when we know that's not the case.
Just let me be clear about something. Were you ultimately seeking one arbitration involving all of the parties named in these separate actions, or were you seeking a number of individual arbitrations?
I represent Mr. Schneider in this instance.
Uh-huh.
Mr. Schneider was an employee of Morgan Stanley. Contrary to what appellant stated earlier, everything in the complaint relates to conduct within the scope of his employment. We were trying to compel arbitration. If we had our druthers, being Mr. Schneider and Morgan Stanley and the other claimants, this would have been resolved in one litigation. After all, they're seeking the same damages stemming from the same exact conduct that occurred on the same exact day. Judicial economy would seem to dictate that the best way to resolve a situation like that would be in one proceeding.
The other way to resolve it is with a claim of res judicata.
Which is what we're confronted with right now, because the National Futures Association claim against Morgan Stanley has been resolved. Appellant received no damages. In fairness, Morgan Stanley's counterclaim was also denied. But at the end of the day, anything that gets sent back to arbitration will be argued that collateral is collaterally estopped.
Well, wait a minute. Were you counterclaiming for fees? What were you counterclaiming for?
At the time that appellant's futures account was liquidated, there was what we call a debit balance in the account. The silver's futures market declined so precipitously that after everything was liquidated, there was a negative balance in his account. And we filed a counterclaim to collect that.
Sorry.
It was provided for under the contract. And it's not an unusual lawsuit, I will tell you that.
Under these circumstances?
Yes, under these circumstances. Going back to whether, in the event that this was to be considered a question of fact, the Supreme Court in Moses Cone said any doubts concerning the scope of arbitrable issues should be resolved in favor of arbitration, whether the problem at hand is the construction of the contract language itself or an allegation of...
It's not a problem about arbitral issues. This is a problem about who is within the scope of the arbitration clause.
Which is why I refer back to my earlier primary argument that this is a matter of law to be decided, and that's how all the others...
I don't understand. I don't understand how we're getting anywhere fiddling with presumptions. The Supreme Court, the Arbitration Act, and the Supreme Court say arbitration is a contract. We apply this like any other contract. So we have to figure out what the contract means. That's fine, but lawyers... Well, it's their burden, it's not our burden, and so on, doesn't really help us do that.
Well, I would go back to what I said earlier. The issue here seems relatively simple. Can a corporate employee invoke the benefit of a corporation's arbitration clause?
Is there some reason, by the way, why you didn't make a preclusion argument in the district court?
As I noted earlier, I was not counsel at that time. I know that sounds like an excuse.
I don't care about you personally. When I say you, I mean your client. Your client can have any number of lawyers. Is there some reason why you did not make a preclusion argument in the district court?
None that I'm aware of. To quickly address the waiver argument that was raised at the end of the appellant's argument. While many times courts speak of it in terms of if you can't raise a new issue in a reply brief, the reality is the rule is designed to avoid depriving your opponent of providing an argument in response to your assertions. In this case, a surreply was requested and granted, and it would seem to me that would be the exact reason that surreplies were created in the first place. There was no prejudice to appellant in this instance. And with that, I thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Lewis. Anything further, Ms. Hardy?
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the concerns about the good faith filings of my client, I will concisely tell you this. The claims were filed in the CFTC because at that time we understood that the CFTC provided for appellate review of the decisions that were reached there. As the CFTC proceeding went on, we ultimately determined, and the CFTC agreed, that they did not have jurisdiction to hear all of the claims involved in our lawsuit. When that case was dismissed, we looked at the other available options, that being either the NASD or the NFA. NFA does not have appellate review, and our client asked whether he had any other options. We looked at the arbitration provisions. With respect to Morgan Stanley, there were no other options. With respect to the employees who were acting as employees of Morgan Stanley, there were no other options. But with respect to the three individuals who were acting beyond the course and scope of their employment, he was entitled to not have to arbitrate and to take this to a federal court. There was no federal court in which he could get jurisdiction of all those individuals in the same place. therefore he was entitled to this, whether it was appears to be done with some kind of malicious intent, whether it appears to be a waste of judicial economy, he had the right to do that, and that's what he sought to do. With respect to the non-signatory argument that counsel just addressed, the cases and the issues that he talked about all deal with cases not related to a futures account arbitration provision. Because of these strict regulations under the CFTC new regulations, these arbitration provisions have to be more strictly construed in the language in which they're written. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.